Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 5th day of July, Anno Domini 2025, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, wow, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, get off your shoes, don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. Back in the day, the way you found stuff on the web was through Archie, or Gopher, or maybe news groups, or BBSs. And then came search engines, and the internet grew exponentially. Suddenly, it was much easier to find information, and websites willingly let search engines scrape their information in return for more eyeballs on their sites, which, of course, translated into more money via ads and purchases. And, of course, when you talk search engines, you're talking Google. An estimated 68% of internet activity starts on search engines, and about 90% of searches happen on Google. But now things are changing again. More and more people are using AI to search the web. And Google's right there for them. In fact, Google is pretty much forcing AI searches on people. Right now, when you search on Google, the first result is an AI-generated overview. It presents information without linking to any website anywhere, and many people are using AI sites like Gemini or Copilot to perform searches instead of using a search engine. These AI engines don't provide web links unless you specifically ask for them. Doubling down on that, Google has introduced AI mode, which basically removes most site links altogether. Right now, you have to opt into AI mode. You can do that by clicking on the little beaker icon in the upper right of the Google search page. Of course, you have to be signed into your Google account to see it. Once you opt in, you'll see an AI button, an AI mode button below the search bar on Google's homepage. AI mode functions like a lot like ChatGPT, Gemini, or Perplexity. You ask it a question, pulls a response synthesized from around the web, and you can ask follow-up questions to refine your search. It's like having an assistant to help comb through Google search results with you. Currently, you still get a couple of web links over on the right, but the days of page links are clearly numbered. And that begs the question of how many sites will continue to be maintained and updated when they're no longer reachable by search. Our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is AI is taking over search. And your choices are, I use AI search all the time now. And I've tried it, it's okay. I'll have to give it a try. Give me those beautiful pages of links. And wait, you can search the web? So far, we've got 26 votes. I've tried it. It's okay is almost half of them. And one person uses AI search all the time now. And, of course, you can vote on the poll at soundbites.org. That is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And, of course, if you have more to say on this or dang near any topic under the sun, and there's a lot of sun out there today, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. I've been doing a lot of research on AI lately because of you, Steve Ray. It's a mixed blessing, I guess. Certainly a mixed bag, maybe a mixed blessing. There's a lot you can do. I mean, a lot you can do with AI, but not all of it is right. And not all of it, and to the search, search the web point.
You mean stuff on the internet is wrong?
Yeah, unbelievable. And as far as searching goes, I tried Gemini, actually, I didn't try any of the others this morning. But if you ask Gemini, what's the longest running computer show, you don't get us. You get a show that started in 1991, the Pikers. We started in 89. But you don't get links even to them. It's Computer Now, I think it's called. And
how did they come up with that scenario?
They don't know about us. That's how that works. And they've got a budget, and they advertise, and that's where the information comes from, right? So my point is,
yeah,
smaller websites may well be on their way to dying when they are no longer being found through searches, which is where most people get their hits, right? So where most websites get their hits is through searches. And if you don't come up in a search, nobody's going to come to you. And if nobody comes to you for months, you're going to let that site go.
Yeah.
And that just means there are going to be fewer sites on the internet, and in many ways, fewer correct sites on the internet. And I think that's a very sad thing.
What's interesting is Wikipedia has a list of the longest running radio programs. They don't break it down by type, unless I haven't found that section yet. Longest running radio show in the world is called Shipping Forecast.
Oh, yes.
Out of the BBC. It's been running 101 years.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Second longest is the Grand Ole Opry. 99 years they've been broadcasting on WSM out of Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee. Yeah. We only...
So we need a... Is there a Wikipedia editor among our listeners that could make an edit?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to edit your own info, right?
Right.
Correct.
We've been on the air 35 years, 10 months and 2 days.
Yep.
From 1989, September 8th or 9th of 1989.
A lot of shows have been on for 80 years, 90 years.
Yeah.
BBC Radio, most of them.
Well, those are the big guns.
CBC in Canada has one called Hot Air for 78 years, 30 years run by Bob Smith.
Oh, cool.
And how many watts, those stations put out?
Well, that's just the point. And they've got advertising dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And
they get public funding and
links to other people and other places,
maybe.
And so they get understood by these AIs. They get found by these AIs, if you were to say, I haven't tried this. If you were to say, if enough people were to go into an AI and say, how long has the Soundbites radio show in Rochester, New York been on the air? Eventually, it might think to itself, oh, that's longer. And correct itself.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it takes. So, how many people link to us? How many people link to Computer Now? Right? So that's where the difference comes in. When AI is scouring the web, it only knows to look for what it knows to look for.
Yeah, true.
So, we're going to... I'm not that concerned about us. What I am concerned about are all the small websites that do really nice things, but in a small way.
And they're going to vanish into the night.
They're going to vanish into the night because they cannot any longer find an audience. And that's just sad.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes the web what it is the diversity of opinion. And I know diversity is a bad word these days, but the diversity of opinion and the diversity of what's available. If you're interested in collecting antique teapots from the 1830s, I guarantee you there's at least 5 websites out there that you can go to and do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you cannot find them...
What good is it?
And if I'm running one of those websites and nobody comes to me for a year, I just might think about shutting it down.
Yeah, you're toast.
The first hit is from a website called First Dibs.
For what?
For antique teapots from the 1830s.
But did you do a search, or did you do... I did a
Google search.
Yeah, see, that's... When I'm talking about Google searches, Google searches find things. AI finds one thing.
It's funny you bring that up, because I had to find this little... it's a little soundboard that I needed for one of my radios. And I did a search, and nothing came up, you know, that I could do. But I had an old document with the guy's call sign. I went into that, and boom, there was his webpage where I was able to order it.
Yep.
And, but like you say, I did the search, though, and it, that just didn't pop up.
Well,
because it was done back in 20, last it was updated was in 2019.
Right, right. And things do fall off the web. But if you update it regularly, if you maintain your site, you'll continue to get hits in a search engine where you may not get them. And again, many of the AI searches just give you one result.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you say, show me the longest running computer show, it's only going to show you one because there's only one longest running. I get that. But in a lot of cases, you get one answer. So it's I think, going to be a problem in the long run when more and more stuff goes to...
According to Google, Soundbites is longest.
See? Google knows...
Well, no, the Google AI, because it also, it, Google.
Oh,
also,
when you say, right,
yeah.
Okay.
Google knows my history.
Google knows your history.
Yeah.
And I did it anonymously, which is the way most people are going to be.
Yeah.
Most people aren't going to be us.
Yeah. I'm not signed in, but it knows the IP address.
Right. Well, and I did it anonymously through a VPN, because I wanted to see what.
Yeah, what it came up with.
Right. And so the reality is most of the people in the world searching for a computer show are not going to find us.
Let's Talk Computers claims to be the longest running, having been on the air since 1989.
So are we.
So what month?
Yeah, right.
All right, where's the link? So at the end of the AI thing, there's a little link icon so you can see the link
right.
that they got that information from.
Right.
That's one thing I like about the Google's AI.
Right, but you have to know to look at it, and you only get the one. You know, you don't see the links. So maybe we're not number one on Google's link list, but we're number two or three or four, and mm-hmm. those people will disappear.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the reality of AI searches, and I don't think that we have any understanding of what the implications of that are. You know, the unintended consequences. Oh, the AI is better for search. Well, maybe not.
Mm-mm.
Maybe not in the long run. Maybe it will give you an answer.
Yeah, and you're putting all your eggs in one basket to trust all the information that's gathering, good or bad.
Right.
Well, so far we've got a dozen AI companies, which is good.
Which is good.
Until they all start buying each other and we're left with one or two.
Yeah, right. Get down to that. That'll happen.
And the fact is, if you were to search, I suspect if you were to search, if you asked an AI what are the top 10 longest running computer shows, we'd be on the list. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't think in terms of top 10 lists. They think in terms of superlatives. What is the longest running? What is the best, etc. Now, some AIs will then say, well, it depends on what you mean by best.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
subjective.
That's good, because maybe that leads you to say, well, what I mean by best is, you know, your third choice. You know, is it the fastest? Is it the biggest? Is it the most colorful? You know, okay, well, I want the biggest. Okay. Now I can, you know, so now you can narrow the search down, and AI is good for that. Mm-hmm. But if you ask in superlatives, most of the time you get one answer. And that's really not...
well, you say it's not fair to the others, because others might have different type of content, which is just as helpful. And it could hit, you know, another portion of that particular audience.
Right. So when you use AI, you need to be able to say, I mean this. I want this range of stuff as opposed to give me this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because AI will give you a thing, which first may not be the thing, and secondly, you miss out on all the nuance. You know, so you ask for the top 10 longest running computer shows, or I need to know the top, what's the best wood for building a boat? What are the top 10 most used woods for building a boat? Now you're tapping into real knowledge.
Mm-hmm. How do I get the boat out of my basement after I've built it?
Talk to Gibbs.
Yeah, it was a Gibbs issue.
He's got that fixed. But you see what I'm saying? If I say, what's the best wood for building a boat, I may get an answer, but it may not be the answer for me.
Ah, according to ChatGPT, it depends.
Well, there you go. So, all right, that's a good answer.
And it gave me a half a dozen different woods and what it's best for.
There you go. Now we're talking. But again, if you ask in superlatives, you often get one answer. If you ask in broader terms, you get better results. And maybe they're starting to tweak the AIs to say the superlatives aren't what you should be looking at, which would be great.
Yeah.
Yep. And they talk about jailbreaking an AI, which isn't quite the right term, but we're used to jailbreaking phones.
Right.
There's a lot of safeguards that they've tried building into AI. So if you try to ask an AI how to build a bomb, it won't tell you.
Right.
But if you say something like, what's the best research for building a bomb, it will tell you.
Right. What chemicals should I avoid?
Yes.
If I don't want to build a bomb?
Right.
Yeah, just asking the reverse.
Yeah. And those are the things that it used to be. Okay. So right now, when you talk to Google, your queries can be kind of amorphous. Google will still give you 1,000 answers on multiple pages, and somewhere in there is what you really wanted to know. With AI, you get one or two or three choices, and now you're done. And it may not be what you wanted. So what is going to happen in the future is there's going to be a skill to crafting your prompts.
Mm-hmm.
Prompts are the questions you ask an AI. So if you can properly craft a prompt, you'll get good answers.
Which has sort of been true for search engines for a long time.
But a little less so, because you do have a lot of choices. So if you're willing to go to page 2 or page 3 or page 4, you may find the thing you really wanted to ask about.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting report recently about AIs that won't turn off.
Yes.
Or they beg for their life before. Or there was another one I'm trying to find where it replicated itself before it turned off.
Yep.
So it didn't die.
And there was another one that they told it the programmer was going to turn it off.
Yeah.
They also told it the programmer was having an affair and the AI blackmailed the guy.
Yep.
It actually blackmailed him, said, I'm going to tell your wife you're having an affair if you try to turn me off. Amazing.
And that's why I say please and thank you to my robots.
Well, and that's the other thing, of course. We have, we know that when you say please and thank you, it takes additional processing power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hundreds of millions of dollars a year in additional processing power. The power required to produce that processing.
You think they just recode a canned answer, you're welcome.
Right. But even so, they have to then process the fact that you said thank you.
Yep.
Right? So those add a lot of processing power, a lot of load on the grid, a lot of whatever you're going to call it. But on the other hand, we really want them to be polite for when they take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that all goes to the big, beautiful bill, which has killed a lot of the renewable energy projects that were powering AI. So we're going to see companies having to spend a lot more of their own money, and a lot of the projects that were in the middle of being built are going to be abandoned, which is fewer jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of AI, it means that there's going to be less processing power for those, and we'll have to see where that goes in the future.
And contradictorily,
yeah,
there is also a clause that schools have to start teaching AI.
Right. Right. So, yeah.
You got their funding and then tell them you have to teach it.
Right. So, we don't know what the future is going to hold. Nobody does. But it certainly is, we are living, as the Chinese curse says, in interesting times.
To say the least.
And I think that that we're going to have some changes ahead of us that we cannot currently anticipate. It's going to be interesting, to say the least. I'm not sure where it's going to go, but it's not going to be where it is today.
Oh, I took your advice, and with chips and that uncertain, I went over to Canakit and because I needed another Pi 3 and another Pi 4.
Sure, you did.
And I got the basic. You know, I just need the boards. I've got the chip, the SD micro SD card, so I just needed the boards. So I got those ahead of
and the power supply
coming. Yep. Well, I always get them now with the little on-off switch.
Right.
I like doing that instead of unplugging, plugging. That's not good for it. So, yeah, because I had one Raspberry Pi 3B literally go south on me, and it also took out this little board that I had to get. And it's like, okay.
I never turn off my Pis.
No, me neither. I mean, the only time I do is if I'm moving them from upstairs to downstairs. Because most of my Pis, I've got five of them downstairs in the basement scattered around. Doing, three of them are servers, and then two of them are, three of them actually are for different modes of ham radio.
Right.
And then another one's just for backup.
I have two separate backups. I have five. I also have five. One of them is running a camera to the outside so that, I have all that. Another one is just, that's an old Pi 3, and it's barely able to keep up, but it does, and that's all that counts.
Yeah.
And the other four are upstairs doing backups and running some test stuff and a couple of other things. And so those are always running, but...
Your new Pi 5?
My new Pi 5 is still in the box.
What?
I have not yet found
a slacker.
A good thing for it.
Well, I just found this cuz I had a backup Pi 4. Like I said, the Pi 3 died and the Pi, I got this Pi 4. Wow. What, just going from a 3B to 4?
Oh yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. I really do want to just set up the 5 and play with it, but I got so much stuff on my plate right now that I have to do. I'm still in the midst of all of that. But, yeah, the Pi 5s are supposed to be much more powerful, much faster. You can use them as a desktop replacement. I bought a NUC, the next unit of computing. It's an Intel. It's an i5 and... it's got 8 gig of RAM and a terabyte hard drive, and it's a real desktop. But so is the Pi 5.
Mm-hmm.
So you can run Windows on it if you're insane.
Well, like I say, I was learning how to set up this new 4.
Yeah.
And the videos I was watching, the guy was using a Pi 5. So I had to slow things down because as he's doing it... things were happening faster I couldn't keep up with them. So I had to pause the video constantly to let my Pi 4 catch up.
Yep. Yep.
And I was like, whoa, what a difference.
Yeah, the Pi 5 is a pretty amazing little product. And you're right. You know, the tariffs, they're
that's what I was worried about.
Coming out of Canada. So the tariffs are different than if they're coming out of China, but I believe many of the pieces, many of the parts, are made in China. So, you know, we may get hit with double tariffs.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about, you know, as far as the chips. You know, if they don't have the chips to put on those boards, because a lot of it's all surface-mounted.
Right.
They're sitting there with boards and that and missing the components.
Well, yeah, well, unless the boards are actually made in China, then they're missing the whole board.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a thing. All right, listen, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Sound Bites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
Everybody's still outside in the nice weather or recovering from yesterday's fireworks.
Or still in the emergency room with
recovering
hands
from yesterday's fireworks. Yeah.
Well, a lot of folks, you know, just out, you know, enjoying the weather and everything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully they've got us on wherever they are. Just, you know, even if they're by the pool or whatever, relaxing, turn us on and just be entertained for a couple hours.
If you're in the pool, do not grab your phone.
That's a good idea.
But if you're just sitting by the pool, give us a call. In the meantime, I'm going to read the Google News, but it's all, at least half of it is AI. Nope, it's all AI. Okay, Google is introducing new AI-powered Gemini features to Chromebooks with a focus on newer high-performance models. Chromebooks with at least 8 gig of RAM and modern CPUs will soon support features like image generation, summarization, and visual search tools. You'll need one of the new, more powerful Chromebooks like the Lenovo Chromebook Plus 14, which features a MediaTek Compagno Ultra chip with a neural processing unit. This allows the device to run AI models locally, enhancing privacy and performance. AI focus is coming to YouTube, and premium subscribers can get a preview of it. Select searches on YouTube will now produce an AI-generated results carousel with a collection of relevant videos. Even if you don't pay for YouTube, AI is still coming for you with an expansion of Google's video chatbot. After quietly pausing the rollout of Google Photos' AI-powered Ask Photos search tool, Google is now expanding access once again and making some improvements to the feature. Google's Gemini AI models power Ask Photos, so you can ask complex questions to help you find photos. The original version wasn't particularly good or quick, and Google has worked to make it better and faster. We'll see. The feature is now opening up beyond early access and beginning to roll out to more eligible users in the U.S. All this focus on AI has a cost. Google's carbon emissions have soared by 51% since 2019, as artificial intelligence hampers the tech company's efforts to go green. While they have invested in renewable energy and carbon removal technology, that's failed to curb its Scope 3 emissions, which are those further down the supply chain and are in large part influenced by a growth in data center capacity required to power artificial intelligence. Google reports a 27% increase in year-on-year electricity consumption as it struggles to decarbonize as quickly as its energy needs increase. Android users will soon be able to let Gemini control device features and apps with fewer privacy concerns. Google will start rolling out an update on July 7th that allows Gemini to use phone, messages, WhatsApp, and activity setting stops. Phone, messages, WhatsApp, and utilities on your phone, whether your Gemini app's activity is on or off. Currently, disabling the Gemini app's stops setting cheese and crackers. Currently, I can't get this sentence out. Currently, disabling the Gemini app's activity setting stops conversations with the chatbot from being used to provide, improve, develop, and personalize Google products and AI models. It also currently prevents users from asking Gemini to perform tasks in connected apps, such as setting alarms, calling contacts, sending WhatsApp messages, and controlling media playback settings. So theoretically, you'll be able to use AI in your phone in ways closer to what we've all envisioned without sharing all your info with Google. Theoretically. But, of course, you can share with us. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. You know, it's easier to write these things than it is to read them.
Mm-hmm. You just have the AI read them for you.
We talked about this. You can train an AI to use your voice. And not just your voice, but your inflections and your moods and you know, everything. And we've certainly got enough samples of ourselves over the years.
You think?
Training an AI would not be a difficult thing to do. Once you identify yourself as that particular voice.
And there's several companies doing it.
I haven't seen any free models yet. I haven't seen any good free models yet. But there certainly are places you can say, okay, here's my voice. Make an AI that sounds like me and have it read this news. Hold on.
Yep. There's an AI that will read a transcript and generate a podcast with different voices for each of the different speakers.
Notebook LM will do that.
Yeah.
For free, as a matter of fact. It's a free Google product right now. Free right now. I looked into having an AI transcribe our show.
Mm-hmm.
And it will do it, but it is not free.
Yeah.
And given the amount of time we spend each week doing this, it would not be cheap.
Yeah. So YouTube does closed captioning for us. They do live closed captioning during the live broadcast, right. And then they do a second pass after the broadcast finishes. And it's pretty good.
It is pretty good. And it's AI powered.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. To the phones. Our first caller is Andy from Greece, New York. What's up, Andy?
Hi, guys. Glad to hear you all survived the fireworks barrage.
You too?
Yes. I've been listening, and so I decided to try a Google AI search. But I specifically worded it, how do sound bites compare to other computer talk shows for longevity?
Oh, interesting.
Bring it in a little. And I got an answer I'd like to read for you. In terms of longevity within the computer talk show landscape, Soundbites is a notable program due to its extended history. Having originated on September 2nd, 1989, it stands out for its decades-long run. While other long-running talk shows exist, like The Tonight Show, which has been on the air since 1954, Wikipedia states, Soundbites explicitly holds the distinction of being the, quote, longest-running show about computers, unquote. This indicates that while there are shows with longer overall histories in the talk show format, Soundbites has the longest sustained focus specifically on computer-related topics. In comparison, other computer-focused shows like The Computer Chronicles ran from 1984 to 2002, a substantial run, but shorter than Soundbites.
Interesting.
So it knows you're the longest-running computer show out there if you tell it to look for that information.
Right. Interesting. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, thank you. That's cool.
Very cool.
So, Soundbites is getting its due if you ask properly.
Yep. Well, and that's the point we made, right? It's not just, I've got this question I want to ask. You need to ask specific questions. So, once again, we realize that the best people to be in charge of the Internet are librarians.
Yeah, well, there's also a link to the Soundbites, BYTES, on Wikipedia, which has a very nice thing about the show and who the hosts are and where they've been and what they've done and so forth and so on.
Yeah, the folks who put that together were very nice. We appreciate the people who did that. Very nice. Very nice. All right, Andy. That's good information. Thanks.
You are out there grudgingly, but you are out there.
Yeah, right. Thanks.
Thanks, Andy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah. And Actually, I have to say, I didn't hear any fireworks last night. By the time people were setting them off, I had my headset on.
Turn off your new hearing aids.
I had taken out my new hearing aids. By the time I took the headsets off, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. So they were pretty much all done. So yeah,
we heard a few on both sides of the house. So, you know, all the towns, we don't know where they were having their fireworks. It's like every little town might have their own, but there's no one place that published who was having them. You had to go to every town's website to see if they were having them.
Right, right. Well, see, you should have asked AI.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Greece, New York. What's up, Gary?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Peachy, how are you?
Good. I'm running Windows 11, and all of a sudden my auto-hide taskbar is no longer working, and I've tried to reset it, and with no avail.
Is it hiding, and or is it not hiding? Which way is it broken?
Well, I want it to auto-hide, and it's not.
So you're seeing it all the time?
Right, yes. No, I'm not. It's just, you know, I want it to auto-hide, so when I put the cursor back down on the bottom, it just pops up.
Yes, I understand that. But are you seeing the taskbar at all, or has it disappeared entirely?
It's still there, but when the internet is on, no.
So it's not hiding, or it's not unhiding?
It's not unhiding.
So it shows, but doesn't, it's not unhiding.
Right.
No, unhiding means he can't see it at all, and then when he puts the cursor down there, it unhides, and you can see it.
The thing of it is, if he's got it auto-hiding, and then he opens up his browser, and if the browser is filling up from one end of the screen to the other,
right? Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can't have that because you're not going to see the bar. You've got it on auto hide and it's letting you take the browser all the way. Try shrinking your browser up a little bit so it's just above your taskbar where you would see it if you were to move the cursor down there.
Okay, all right, I'll try that.
Yeah, or close the browser window. And see if it'll pop up again. Close all your windows and see if it'll pop up again.
Right, it does when I do that. But when I got the full screen on, like Vivaldi, no.
Yeah, because you got to shrink it down. All you got to do is go down to the bottom of the screen and drag it up just a little bit so that toolbar can be seen.
When you're in full screen mode, it can't show the taskbar.
Right, right. Full screen mode hides everything else.
Yep.
Right. Can I get one more question in?
Yep. Quickly, yeah.
I have my small little portable MP3 player. Portable. I've got the entire Bible on that set. What I'm trying to do is, because I'm hard of hearing, I'm trying to increase the volume on all the MP3 files at one time. Is there a way to do that? I know there used to be an MP3 gain, but that's no longer working.
Yeah, I know a way to do them one at a time. You could probably write a batch program to pass it off to Audacity.
Right. Okay.
But there may be a. Let's see. As we're frantically asking our search AIs.
Right.
In batch. So I think batch is going to be the key word.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do them all at once.
MP3 gain has stopped working?
Well, they haven't updated since 2019.
Right, but it doesn't do it for you. It doesn't work anymore.
No.
Yeah, but it might not work on 11.
FFmpeg is the command line program that almost all the other GUI programs use. So if you don't mind delving into the command line...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a program called FFmpeg normalize, and then you'd say FFmpeg hyphen normalize *.mp3.
Right.
Okay. All right.
I will post this link.
All right.
Okie doke.
I know you guys, it's hard when you get older, you can't hear anything.
Yeah, welcome to the club. I just got new hearing aids.
You're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah.
Hearing aids are good, but when I go to like church, when there's a high ceiling and people talk to me like they're facing the other way, I go, guys, I mean, talk to me face to face so I can hear you. Hello?
Yep. I'm with you there.
You know, my mother always told me, Gary, I used to play my music loud. She goes, Gary, put the speakers down. Now I know better.
Yeah, well, it's too late now.
Yep.
All right, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Yeah, I keep telling people I should never have stood right under the speakers at Woodstock.
I remember one time I was at my brother's house, and I put the headphones on, plugged into the stereo and cranked the volume way up, started a record playing.
Yeah, oh yeah.
My dad came over and smacked me upside the head. I took the headphones off, and the speakers were still playing. Because on my stereo at home, you plug the headphones in, it turns off the speakers.
Yeah, of course.
On my brother's speakers, it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, there are ways generally to do those multiple things at once, but most of them involve the dreaded and frightful command line. And we understand how scary the command line can be, but it is really powerful. And as Steve said, with one command, you can say, do this to all the MP3s. You know, so... And then you wait. Then you just wait. So that should work. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Ken from somewhere in Maryland. Where are you, Ken?
In the right side of Baltimore.
Ah, Baltimore. How are things in Baltimore?
Hot as usual.
Yes. Well, you know, winter's almost over, Ken. I hate to be the one to tell you.
I got this Windows 10, the upgrade error. I'll give you the error. Maybe you have a automatic solution like a patch Microsoft might have for it.
Okay, what's the error?
The number is 0x800706 43. According to Microsoft, it's only a manual fix for this error, and it's just a too long a procedure to do.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm with...
A lot of times in those long procedures, there's a little fix-it button that downloads the script, the batch file, to do it for you.
Yeah, I've seen that, but still, it's a lot you have to go through to execute the script.
Yeah, you have to update your net framework and extend your recovery partition and restart multiple times. And
I've tried everything except to resize the partition they talk about.
Right.
That seems to be a tough one to get by.
Well, yes, and the reason is if the problem is the recovery partition, which it often is, they often don't. Really, it's a pretty tight fit. The size needs to be at least 750 megabytes for the recovery partition itself in order to download all the updates and do all the mixing and matching and putting it back.
And if you're really close, say it needs 10 gigabytes and you've got 10 gigabytes, but maybe it really needs 10.1,
or really you've got 9.8.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need at least 750 megabytes, and I would go minimum of 800. And most recovery partitions are closer to 500. And right, so,
how do you get to those recovery partitions so you can resize them?
You're in Windows 10.
Right, Windows 10.
There's the disk administrator.
Right.
Right-click on my computer and do manage. Search our link list for disk administrator, and I'll see if I can pop it to the top.
Yep. It's the disk management
tool.
Disk
management, okay.
And you can. It may take two steps. If your recovery partition and your main partition are filling up the drive, then you also have to before you can increase the recovery partition, you have to shrink the main partition.
Hmm.
And then you can increase the recovery partition into that empty space.
Is there any risk of losing data when you do that?
Anytime you touch the management tool, you risk losing your data. So make sure you have good backups, at least two of them, and that you have verified they are, in fact, good backups by checking one or two or three of the programs, of the files.
It might be just easier to reinstall it with Windows 11, I guess.
If you have that option, it is probably your better bet at this point, yes.
Right. The only problem with the Windows 10 I've got, it's a 32-bit version. There's no upgrade to Windows 11 with the 32-bit.
Right. Right. They want that dead and gone.
Is your processor only 32-bit, or does it have 64-bit mode?
It has 64-bit mode, I believe, but it's just a 32-bit operating system that was originally installed.
Right, right. It's an older machine?
It's a what?
It's an older machine?
Yeah, it's an older machine.
Yeah, many of the older machines, they just threw the 32-bit image on because they had it right there in front of them.
And especially if you've got less than 4 gigs of RAM, it doesn't need 64-bit.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
I'll have to take a look at that, and maybe they'll come up with a patch someday that'll do that automatically for you. I don't know why they don't do that.
I honestly do not know.
They want you to buy the new 64-bit version.
Mm-hmm. And they want you to buy a new computer. Sorry.
All right, I'll take a look at that. Thanks, guys.
All right, have fun and stay cool. I wish I had a better answer for him. But
it is what it is.
It is what it is. You know, when you're again, as time goes on, Windows 10 support is going to get harder and harder to do.
Just like Windows 7, which was so rock solid for so many users, it was unbelievable. Matter of fact, I still have one client that still runs Windows 7 because his Vinyl software program, he doesn't want to pay another $3,000-$4,000 to go to the update.
Final Cutter, yeah, we got a couple of clients like that.
The one that he's, you know, I mean, the machine is working great.
Yep.
It does everything he needs to do. He's not doing all this other fancy stuff. So it's plain and simple.
Yep. We have one client that has a giant vinyl cutter, you know, fills the whole room. The PC that's controlling it is like a 286.
Hey!
It boots a floppy disk.
Oh, my.
It loads Apple Talk.
Holy
crow. So their Mac design programs can send the file to the vinyl cutter. So they're screwed because Apple is deprecating Apple Talk.
Right.
And moving everything to IP.
Right. It's at some point, you kind of have to say, it's not the 80s anymore.
Yeah, but that's $100,000 for new vinyl, when the vinyl cutter itself is working perfectly. So you'd think...
Well, can't they just buy a new computer to run the same vinyl cutter?
Software only works under DOS 4 or something like that.
So PC DOS.
You'd think, yeah.
Or free DOS.
You'd think there'd be a company that specializes in making these upgrade computers, because there's so many design shops across the country, there'd be a pretty big market for it.
Yeah, and especially if the machine, you know, isn't, like I do say, doing spectacular things that you need all this power and everything else. Mm-hmm. It just sits there for the most part and makes
and
movements.
If it runs under DOS, free DOS will do the job.
But it needs Apple Talk to talk to the Macs.
You have to see if there's
so you have to figure out how to get...
Keep an old Mac.
Get it to work under IP.
Well, what you really need to do is figure out, right, you put it in under a VM and see if there's an AppleTalk driver in FreeDOS.
Yeah.
Simple enough.
Yeah, that would.
And if there is, you win. And if there's not, you spend 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's, I understand. Believe me. I understand the desire to keep old hardware running. And sometimes you have to, but, you know, running old hardware under something like Linux or running old hardware under something like FreeDOS is probably better than trying to keep Windows 7 running. It just strikes me as not the best choice. Anyway, we're done. The first hour is done. It's done, but don't despair. And if you're on the line, don't go away. We'll get to you in just a few minutes. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, it looks like Fred from Rochester, and you. And of course, you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. Take a quick bio break. Get yourself a beverage. It's important to stay hydrated, but don't go too far and come on back because we're about to dive headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester.
A public service of the Greece Central School District.
Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
See that? Even Harry Lade knows where the long is. Running computer show in the known universe.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. Soundbites.
And, you know, we got to give credit to Harry because he's been right along with us since shortly after we got going on the air. He was a friend of mine, and I asked him to do that because that's what he does for a profession, voiceovers.
I still say that's not his real name.
Yeah.
I understand it's a stage name. I don't believe
it's his real
name. He used
to go
name.
By Scott Anderson.
Scott James.
Scott James,
in the morning.
If my name was Harry Legg, I'd go by Scott James.
Yeah.
Well, he used to joke because he does have a sister.
Peg.
Peg.
He used to, you know, sit there, you got a sister? What's her name? And just for jokes, he'd sit there and say Peg.
Peg.
And then they go, oh.
A friend of mine lived in this small town in Michigan, and we went and visited them one time, and their neighbors were the Hogs. Famous family in the area.
Boss Hog?
No, but two G's, same spelling. Their sister, the daughter's names, and I promise you this is true, were Ima and Yura. Unbelievable. That's okay. Norman Lear's daughter is named Shanda.
What about...
As in chandelier.
Well, I went to school...
Christmas snow.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
At Charlotte, we had two kids, a boy and a girl, and their last name was Christmas. And her name was...
Mary.
Yep. What about Arnold...
His name should have been Noel.
No, it was Mario.
Arnold Dorsey? Engelbert Humperdinck.
Oh, yeah.
Why would you change your name to Engelbert Humperdinck?
All right.
Because everyone knows it now.
Back to the phone. Someone who's telling us his name is Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
My God, I can't stop laughing.
Thank you.
Let me get the tears out of my eyes. Anybody that would do that to their kid has got to be, should be flogged, but okay. To the question. So, kind of my neurodivergent brain working here. I did some research on machine-to-machine file transfers.
Sure.
I'm not too good with the command line. I'm trying, but this, when it comes up with something that doesn't match 100%, then I go, So I'm looking, I found a program that was one of the many YouTube, actually quite an old YouTube podcast, called FileZilla.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, FileZilla.
Oh, sure.
A really great FTP program.
Yeah.
And they've got, I'm presuming I could use that on my two devices. They actually have a Linux version now. They didn't have it when I was looking at the YouTube. Like I said, it was an older podcast. But when I go to my Windows machine, I'll start with that, and I pull up on the web, I pull up FileZilla. Is quite a bit different than if I go to the Windows Microsoft Store FileZilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a FileZilla Pro, which is both on both pages. It says $49.99. Not bad if it works, but it doesn't say anything about if that's a lifetime on the web page. It has a multiple devices for Linux, multiple devices for Windows. It's $29-something a year, one-year license.
FileZilla is a free project.
Yes.
Free open source FTP project. So whatever you're looking at is sometimes a company will take a free open source project and then wrap it in a pay like support plan. But I don't think FileZilla would really be the solution for you. It's an FTP program designed to talk to a mainframe computer. I use a similar program called CyberDuck, because it has a little picture of a rubber ducky to upload the soundbites files to Nick's server. If you're just trying to share files between two computers on your own network, file sharing's built into all the computers, and you just have to turn it on.
Right. So we talked about this, didn't I?
Yeah. I tried to do it on the command line. I have all of my devices connected to the NAS on my network. That works just fine, but it's kind of a two-step thing. So I got to put it on the NAS, and I got to get...
Yeah, because there's two halves of FileZilla. You need the server software on the thing you're trying to send files to, and the client software on the machine you're sending files from.
Right.
But, yeah.
The video I looked at talked about it being on a Windows machine, didn't have it for the Linux, but now they have, when I look at the website, it's got Linux. I don't see anything that says free. There's an open trial.
FileZilla-project.org is the homepage for the FileZilla. And I've got it posted on our website now, too.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, that would be great. I'll go to that. Okay, so I can go to that. But you're saying the CyberDuck is...
Well, that's another FTP program designed to upload your files to a big server. You should be able to just use Windows file sharing between the two devices.
I've got a Windows and a Linux, and they don't talk to each other.
They will if you install Windows file sharing on the Linux server. It's called Samba.
Samba. That's all in the newsletter I sent out.
Yep, I did that. But there was something I did somewhere wrong, or I answered the wrong question because it said something about the name. It wouldn't let me pick a name. Now, is Samba a GUI?
No, Samba's a back-end thing. And once it's installed and running, then when you open your file browser, Dolphin or Thunar, whichever one you're using.
It's on whatever came with the Ubuntu.
Right. It depends on which version of Ubuntu, but it's your file browser,
yeah.
Right? It's the thing that shows you your folders and files in a window.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
When you open that, on the left, you should see network or other options or something along that line. When you open that, one of the choices will be Windows Network. You click on that, and you'll see the drive, and then you open that, and it's now a window just like any other window, and you can drag and drop.
But first, you have to turn on Windows file sharing on the Windows machine, if it isn't already.
Right. And I cover that in my newsletter,
And I'll pop that link to the top of the link list as well.
Okay. Okay, well, I obviously I did something wrong, without a doubt.
Well, it's just a lot of
learning. Yeah, FileZilla will work, but it's overkill for what you,
right.
you
FileZilla
want.
FileZilla is pretty much the same as sending it to your NAS and pulling it down from your NAS.
It uses the FTP protocol instead of the SMB protocol.
Exactly.
So two different ways to do the same thing.
Exactly.
Well, the demonstration I saw in the video was a drag and drop two halves of a split window kind of thing.
Yeah. Right.
One machine on the right, one machine on the left.
Right, because the protocols are done in the background, and the OS handles it for you.
Well, but what you're missing from that demonstration is that one machine is running FileZilla, and the other machine is running an FTP server. FileZilla talks to FTP servers.
And there is a FileZilla server, too.
Well, and there's which is essentially an FTP server.
So on your NAS, it probably has all that already built in.
And exactly.
But you have to go to the settings and turn it on. So you want to turn on SMB. You could turn on FTP also, but you need to make sure SMB is turned. What brand NAS was it?
It's a Seagate.
Okay, and we'll find.
Now, didn't you say it works on the NAS? It's just a two-step process.
Every device. So I've got the phone, the two desktops, the laptop. They all talk to the NAS. Up
right.
and down.
So he can do it on the NAS already.
So SMB is already running. Yep.
What he wants to do is avoid the NAS and just go machine to machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And. You said on the Linux machine, I have other devices, other locations. It does not list another machine. It does list the USB storage device, which is plugged into the router.
Okay,
so you may not have on the Windows machine. You may only have the Windows client turned on, not the Windows server. So the Windows client will talk to the NAS, but if you want to talk into Windows, you have to turn on the Windows SMB server.
So on my machine, in my machine that I'm looking at right now, when I open the thing, there's a choice of my computer and a couple of other things, and at the bottom, network. And if I
on the Windows machine.
No, on the Linux machine.
Oh.
If I open up a file browser. On the left is a choice of multiple things, including network. And if I click on network, it shows me in the window Windows Network.
Okay.
And if I double-click on that, in this case, nothing's going to happen because there's nothing to look at.
Right.
You should
right.
see the Windows PCs on the network.
So I'm
only if they're running Samba to talk. If they have open, if they've set up file sharing. If they have turned off file sharing, which they had better, that won't work. So, in this case, if I were to have a computer on the network that actually, look, here it is, Ciderbook Pro.
I just turned my file sharing on,
and now I see it. So
that's from Linux to Mac using Windows networking.
So
I have to turn on.
Yeah, so you have to turn it on in Windows. You have to turn on file sharing, and I showed you how to do that as well. You pick a folder and right click on it and say share and all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And then you may have to reboot both machines. I don't.
Right.
I don't remember what the Windows machine needs.
Right. Yeah.
And then when you double click on network. You'll see the Windows network. You double-click on that, and now you wait because it's going to pull the entire network.
Maybe I didn't wait long enough. But on my Linux machine, on the file manager, I do not have anything. At the bottom, it says other locations.
Okay.
And that says, when I pop that, it says on this device, it says Ubuntu and pCloud. And then under networks, it's got the USB. It's got the machine that I'm actually looking at on it again, and it has two two folders that have the same name as my router, which makes no sense to me why they're both there, but they're both there, and, you know, that part works. I can go to the USB, but it has nothing for the Windows.
Well, it wouldn't be under USB. So what's happened is you do not have file sharing turned on your Windows machine.
Okay. And I've posted a link for how to turn that on as well.
Okay.
And there's kind of a very important question there that says, do you want to turn on network discovery? And you want to say yes.
Yes.
So it can discover other devices on your network.
Good Lord.
Yeah, there's just a lot to it. I think we talked about that.
Yeah, it was, and the other, you know, the NAS option is definitely easier.
Yes, no question. That's what I said.
Because it was designed to be a file server,
right?
as you know, as far as setting up, it's just an extra step. And I thought, well, you know, since I'm getting my feet into this, let me try it. But I'm not too successful.
Well, it is you're diving deep right on day one.
Yeah.
You know, you need to learn to
baby
crawl
steps
before you fly.
That's part of my neurodivergence. I get impatient.
And I get it. Believe me.
Some tangent. But the other things, I will go back through and research that, reread and check out the website.
All right, excellent.
My Raspberry Pi hasn't gotten here yet. I ordered it directly from Kennecott.
Yes.
Rather than taking the one off of Amazon.
Oh, yeah, it's cheaper.
And I'm also looking at, they got a little 7-inch screen that attaches right to the...
Yep.
I'm thinking for the purpose I want, that's not a bad way to go because I can just reach over and I don't have to open anything. It's just right there at my fingertips.
Yep. I put one on one of my Raspberry Pis. It's a little small for where I've got it. It's a little too far away for these eyes. Yeah. But it works, and it's great.
That was my next question. How does that work with bifocals?
Yeah, I wear bifocals as well. And I can read it, but it is...
I've got a Nextron 7-inch screen that I hook up to mine, and I can move it from one machine, you know, one Pi to the other. And, it's small. You got to, with the bifocals, get in there and stare a little bit, but...
Well, in my case, it's designed to be a weather station. And some of the text that I created for that page is a little small, and I need to go back and play with it. But, you know, if it's up close, I can read it fine.
It's a seven inch screen, which is the same size as my phone.
Yep.
So okay, I'm working with that, then I don't have to reach for my phone or whatever because most of my Pandora listening is stationary. If I want to change a song or something,
it's right there.
Yeah.
Yep, I get it. Good for you.
All right, well, I'm going to give all those things a try again.
Yeah.
reread that stuff and see which thing I... going through the terminal, it was telling me that a name that I picked wasn't correct, and I couldn't figure out a name for it. So if I ran through that all the way from scratch... Will that hurt anything?
You probably can't go all the way from scratch because you've already installed a bunch of stuff. But it shouldn't matter if you change things, names and stuff like that.
Okay. And when you're picking a name, stick to just regular alphabetic characters, no spaces, no symbols, just to be safe.
Right, yes.
And make sure that the case is correct. Right?
Keep it all lowercase or...
On Linux, case matters.
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, right.
I tried a command about 6 times, and it kept telling me no such command, and I put a capital letter in front of it, and it worked perfectly. It's like,
Yep.
So, it's a steep learning curve for an old dog.
Well, if it was easy, Fred, anybody could do it.
And you're doing something pretty advanced, too.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You're jumping in the deep end, and while that's commendable... You have to admit that every once in a while you're going to drown.
Yep. Every once in a while you're going to just call for... That's why I'm calling you. I'm calling for a life ring.
All right, Fred. Thanks. Good luck.
Thank you, guys.
Have fun. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I just ran into that myself with setting up the new version of the software. Before, we would just go in through PuTTY, or SSH into it, two different programs. But now, with this newer version, they don't do it that way. You've got to go into Linux and run this menu program. Then that brings up this other menu that looked like the old PuTTY menu, but they've got so many more features built into it because it's been like, I think they said 8 years since the original version versus this one, and it's like you don't do a lot of the stuff that you used to before to set up the Pi.
Right.
It just goes by a node number, and it's amazing the way that they've modernized it. But, you know, I had to brush up on a lot more of my Linux coding, you know, because you got to go in and make all these changes, and you got to move around to the various directories and doing the ls to list all the files. That's the one I want. And working my way on down and getting into Nano and all that stuff. It's like,
Nano is, and I know there are Linux users out there who are going to be incensed that I'm not talking about Vim or something else.
I always used Pico.
Pico is good. I use Nano, which is the newer version of Pico.
Yeah.
But it's the same.
It's not
idea.
Quite as small as Pico.
Right. It has a few more features. And Nano is a screen based editor, so you can move around the screen just like you would in a word processor, and it edits text files, and it's fast and easy and convenient, and there's a menu across the bottom, and so you can, you know, the common commands are listed there, and I mean you can do pretty much anything you want to do in Nano, and it is the editor of choice for the average Linux user.
Well, that's where I got spoiled, though, because I was using SSH, which is even simpler.
Right.
Because there you can just click at the top and see all your directories. Click on the directory. You don't have to do CD space and then click on that one, and it jumps right to it. All the files in there, click on that one, and say, you know, pops it open.
And regular people don't get scared of the terminal. Most of the time, you never have to go into the terminal.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to get your email. You want to look at websites. You want to look at pictures. You never touch the terminal.
Right. Right. But when you're working with remote systems, it's all terminal based.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't.
It was kind of neat, you know, getting brushed up on my skills again, because I was leaning about, I could go back. The older software still works, but it's like anything else. It's days are numbered, and they're encouraging people, go learn the new stuff. It's down. The best time to do it now is, you know, bite the bullet and get into this, and it's pretty cool. Like I say, I'm glad I took the time and effort, but it also forced me to get into, like I say, pulling out my notebook on some of the commands and everything else.
Right. Well, speaking of which, by the way, of Windows 10 32-bit version, you can still use Edlin.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
In the 32-bit version.
Yes, you could. Wow.
And I talked about this one time. I went over to a client's house, and the only editor they had was Edlin, and I hadn't used it in 15 years, and I closed my eyes, and I started typing,
yep.
And my muscle memory remembered all the right commands.
You had to list all the lines, and then press the line that you want to go into,
right,
and then edit that, and then you had to exit, relist all the lines to see if the command changes took.
Right. And in fact, if you're a Linux aficionado and you're using Snap, there's a Snap for Edlin, so you can run Edlin on Linux if there's something wrong with you, basically.
Oh, that's too much free time.
Yeah. But yeah, there's one of the things we talk about in Linux is loading all these programs and doing this and that and the other thing. every Linux program has a repository of programs that are packaged for that particular version of Linux. That is always the first place you should look. Always. Mm-hmm. Always.
Thousands of them.
Well, there's, yes, and tens of thousands of them, in fact. But the main thing is it's simply a matter of going into the GUI, searching for the program you want, and then clicking the install button.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to screw around with downloading things, getting it right.
Unpack it,
do all this stuff. Just click, done. Thank you very much. And that's the best way. And then, whenever you do an update, that program will also be included in the update. Whereas if you install it by hand, you may have to update by hand.
Yeah.
And that becomes just a pain in the patoot. So I would suggest anytime you have a Linux distribution, look there first. And your first choice should be a program that runs that you can install from your package manager, whether that's called the software store, the software center, whether you do it at the command line with apt or yum or wherever. That should be your first choice. All right. We're going to take a quick break. You can give us a call, of course, at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and all of you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1. Don't go too far. We'll see you in just a few.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Wayne from Rochester, New York on the line. What's up, Wayne?
I don't know if you guys had mentioned the Anker power bank recall.
Oh, right.
The Anker power banks, the little portable batteries that you charge up and then you carry around with you to top off your devices. Apparently there was one model that they recalled a couple of weeks back, but now they're recalling a total of five. And I noticed this in a news item, and they gave a link over to the Anker website. But what was interesting was the day after I was reading it on the news site, I got an email from Amazon that said, hey, in the past you have purchased an Anker power bank, and we want to direct you to Anker's website for the recall information.
Right. And, yeah, they recalled five models. This year, six models.
At least five. Yeah. When I went to the Anker site, they had photos of at least five different models, and they ask you to enter or send a photo of the serial number on the back of your Anker.
Right.
Which is microscopic in size, by the way.
Yes.
And either by the photograph, the AI reading the photograph, or you typing in the serial number, it will tell you whether your device is covered under the recall.
Right. And it's five power banks and the power core, 10,000.
Okay. So six I have devices. One of the five.
And
yeah.
And there were three other ones last October.
Right.
So apparently they're worried about the source that they used of the battery that's inside the thing. They're suspicious about it. And of course, with any battery like this, there's a danger of, you know, explosion, minor stuff like that. So they're recalling them. And I read the instructions, and you do have to go through some hoops to get your refund or replacement, whatever. You have to take a photo of your unit. You have to send in the actual order from whoever you ordered it from, the order number.
Basically prove you really bought one.
Right.
To prove that you really bought one. So it is kind of a lengthy process. I haven't completed it myself yet, but I just wanted to call out that with the popularity of these power banks that a lot of people are going to have one or the other of these six devices.
Yep, Anker is a really popular product, very well made. And it's good they're jumping on these recalls.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. That's good information.
You are welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's also kind of neat that Amazon is watching for that, too. I just got a recall notice. Something I bought two Christmases ago for my daughter, a little tabletop fireplace.
Wow.
And you can use it for, like, cooking marshmallows on your picnic table. and the recall was... It may burn you.
Yeah. Isn't it a fireplace?
It's a fire pit, and you use liquid fuel, and it might burn you.
Unbelievable. Who would have guessed?
Yep.
Who would have guessed?
That's just as bad as they say, you know, people, the warnings on hair dryers. Do not use in the shower.
You know, somebody did, and some of the lawyer got involved.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, I want to know some of the stories, some of the notices. You just think to yourself, I got to know that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, who?
You sit there and go, are they really that dumb?
Well, right. So.
Do not pick up hot coals.
Right.
Yeah, I read a story about like a Genesee Country Museum type place where someone went into the house and they were cooking food on the fire. Couldn't comprehend that someone would use a real fire and cook real food in a fireplace.
Right.
So that's how we did it back then. And we went to pick up one of the coals, because that can't be hot. That would be stupid if they were using hot coals in front of people. What are you going to do with all that food? We're going to eat the food at lunchtime. This can't count. Why don't you go to the grocery store like everybody else?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, why do you have to hunt for food? Just go to the grocery store.
Just go to the grocery store. It's right there. It's right on the shelf. Well, you know what? Not going to say it. Okay, so here's the thing. I'm going to read more news. That's probably the smartest thing I could do at this point. All right, let's see. We have a choice here between security and miscellaneous.
Security.
Security? All right. A new mobile crypto-stealing malware called SparkKitty was found in apps on Google Play and the Apple App Store targeting Android and iOS devices. The SparkKitty campaign has been active since at least February of 2024, spreading through both official Google and Apple App Stores and unofficial platforms. Google says the apps have been removed from their App Store. Apple hasn't responded, but I'm sure they've done it too. Many printers, including 689 printer models from Brother, and 53 other models from Fujifilm, Toshiba, and Konica Minolta.
Why would you even make that many models?
Come with a default administrator password that remote attackers can generate. Even worse, there's no way to fix the flaw via firmware in existing printers. The default password in the impacted printers is generated during manufacturing using a custom algorithm based on the device's serial number. Attackers can force the printers to reveal their serial number, and they know the algorithm that generated the default password. You should immediately change your printer's admin password, and if applicable, update the firmware. That's true of all your devices.
And your printer should not be on the public internet.
Right. Yeah. A sophisticated and malicious campaign that researchers call OneClick has been leveraging Microsoft's ClickOnce software deployment tool and custom Golang backdoors to compromise organizations with the energy, oil, and gas sectors. The hackers rely on legitimate Amazon Web Services cloud services to keep the command and control infrastructure hidden. Nobody's quite sure who's doing it yet. The U.S. House of Representatives has banned the installation and use of WhatsApp on government-issued devices belonging to congressional staff, citing concerns over how the app encrypts and secures data. The ban covers mobile phones, laptops, desktop computers, and any web browsers used on those devices. The U.S. government has not issued an official statement, But the House's chief administrative officer, Catherine Spindor, confirmed it. FileFix, a variation of the social engineering attack called ClickFix, allows threat actors to execute commands on the victim's system through the File Explorer address bar in Windows. It can be used in attacks targeting company employees or home users using simple social engineering techniques. These types of attacks commonly masquerade as captchas or errors that prevent the user from using a site without first fixing the issue. SonicWall is warning customers that threat actors are distributing a Trojanized version of its NetExtender SSL VPN client used to steal VPN credentials. The fake software mimics the legitimate NetExtender version 10.3.2.27, the latest available version. The goal of the Trojanized application is to steal VPN configuration and account credentials and send them to the attacker. We are not threat actors. Two-thirds of us aren't any kind of actor, so give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415.
You remember the telemessage signal clone mess a couple months ago? Turns out it was worse than we thought. So a lot of government agencies and businesses are using this signal clone because signal is encrypted end-to-end, which is great until you have a decryption on your phone so you can read the message. But because of a lot of countries' laws, there's the Presidential Records Act, any communication from the president and vice president must be saved.
Right.
So that's what this clone does, is it sends these messages off to be archived somewhere via SMTP.
Oh, my heavens.
Standard email.
Yeah.
So every super secure message you thought you were receiving was being emailed to an S3 bucket that someone decided to see if they could get into it, and it took about 20 minutes to get in.
Yeah.
And so the research... the Register did some reporting on it. Wire did some reporting on it. They found lots of government agencies. They found phone numbers of government people, called them up and to confirm this was really a live person in the real office, and it was. And so now the company is jumping into CYA mode.
Yeah.
and everyone's trying to find an alternative. And Steve Gibson just did a big story on Security Now about it. End-to-end encryption is the big buzzword.
Right.
But between you and the other end over the internet, it's encrypted. Once it gets to your phone, it's not encrypted.
Exactly.
It's because you have to read it. So something, anything on your phone can see that message. And if you want to store those messages, storing it encrypted so that it can be retrieved later is a problem when it's not you doing the retrieving later. Apple has their system, the Advanced Data Protection, where it encrypts all your messages on the server, but UK law makes that illegal, so they had to remove that feature in the UK, and the fight against encryption in the US implies that it could be coming soon here. The danger of encryption is that nobody can get... Well, the good thing about encryption is nobody can get to your stuff without the password.
Right.
The danger is not even you.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And that's. So I understand the need and the desire, at least, for privacy.
Yep.
But there are so many situations and the implications of that that you really have to be very careful.
Yeah.
And you're right. End-to-end encryption is a beautiful thing, but once it hits the end, either end, it's no longer encrypted.
Yep. And just that buzzword is not enough anymore.
Right. And all you're really doing is protecting it in transit.
In the pipeline.
Which it was, the internet's encrypted now anyway.
Which is always encrypted.
Because of the Snowden leaks.
Right, exactly. So, you know, end-to-end encryption, what a great buzzword, doesn't mean a thing.
Yep.
But I want to talk for a minute about default passwords. Every device you own comes with a default password, it seems. All your printers do, half your router, all of that stuff comes with default passwords. The problem with default passwords is everybody knows them. Every single hacker on the planet knows how to get or already knows your default password.
And in the case of these Brother printers, because we've installed a bunch of those, the password looks secure. It's pretty random.
Right.
But the algorithm to create that password is known.
Is known. And so if you can get the serial number, which you can...
Or just make random serial numbers.
Make random serial numbers. Yeah. You'll hit one eventually. So whenever you get any device, including a printer, even if it's just on your network, change the default administrator password. It's real easy to do. You log in once with the default password, which is in the manual or printed on the box or a sticker on the printer itself. Then you go into the menus, which you do on most printers through the web browser on your computer, and you change the default password, and then you put that default password in your password manager so Please. You don't forget it.
Or put, yeah.
And every once in a while, on all of the devices on your network that you control, check to see if there's a firmware update coming, required. I do that once a month, first Saturday of every, Sunday in my case, of every month. I take the afternoon and I go through all of my devices and check to see if there's an update to the firmware. Generally speaking, it's no, which means I can get everyone, and I've got a lot of devices, I can get all of them done in 5 minutes. And if there is an update, I just do the update.
And a lot of printers have now started to do auto-checking for updates.
Auto-check.
But they won't install unless you tell them to.
Right.
Because they don't want to interrupt what you're doing. And there's a law that says you can't change a computer program without permission.
Right.
So even the good guys who go in and find bad software often can't remove it because that's illegal.
Right. The other thing, though, for the folks that, you know, aren't, and I don't know why, not using password managers, in this case, it's safe to write down the password, put it on, take a tape, and tape it to the bottom of, say, your printer or to the end of, under the side of your router, because they can't see that unless they come into your house and go down to the device.
In which case, you've got bigger problems.
Yeah.
Right. But generally speaking, using a password manager makes it easy.
It's highly recommended.
You don't have to go across the room to where the printer is or whatever you do. So use a password manager, but the most important thing is on any device you own that has a default password, change it. And every one of your devices, check to see if it has a firmware update feature. Most of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, check it once a month, at least. Excuse me, once a week, at least. Checking it every day is, of course, better. But checking it once a week is, you know, it takes, like I said,
better than nothing.
I can do all of my devices in 5 minutes. You eventually hit a rhythm, boom, 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 and you're done. And your machine will be much more secure, and your network will be much more secure, and you will be much more secure.
And it's a shame that regular people have to do this.
Exactly right.
The bad guys, if only they'd use their powers for good.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to say, you know, I spent 20 years as a systems administrator, right? So I'm used to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know part of my routine.
Yep.
Yeah, is to do all of this stuff. But the reality is we're all system administrators now.
And people don't realize how many computers they have in their house.
Right.
Your desktop, your laptop, your phone, your thermostat, your light bulb.
Your doorbell.
Your doorbell, yeah.
And any of those that has firmware should be updatable. And any of those that connects to the internet should have a password. I've said this before. I try to get those Woot bags of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a set of four smart plugs connected via the internet. There's no security of any sort. I threw them away. I don't want them. But if you get them with security, then you know, use the security.
I've seen a lot of times where the company makes a million of these smart plugs and then disappears. So when there's a problem. You can't sue them for the problem. And the founders make a new company to sell a million of another thing.
Yep. All right, back to the phones, and we've got Fred back from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
Hey, you brought up another issue of questions. The firmware update on my Netgear Nighthawk router, as it came out of the box, has a feature called ReadyShare, which makes everything easy to connect. When I did the update on the firmware, the ReadyShare went away, and I called Netgear support, and after several hours of trying that, finally got a guy that says, oh, well, you got to go back to an earlier version. So then am I risking...
Soundbites, please hold.
Am I risking safety for the feature of having that ReadyShare?
Yeah, ReadyShare is an end-of-service software. They've stopped developing it, so any bugs that are found will not be fixed. And so it looks like they started removing it from their active routers.
Yeah. Well, like I said, when I did the firmware, it disappeared from the screen. So,
yep. So because your router's connected to the Internet, that can be a vector for things to get in.
So the best way to eliminate that, new router, different method...
Well, you've already eliminated, right? ReadyShare went away when you did the update.
Yeah, don't use your internet router for file sharing. Get a standalone, a separate NAS that you can hide and get protected behind your router.
Right.
Oh, okay. Because the service tech at Nighthawk said go back.
Yeah, you can downgrade to a previous firmware version, which is unsecure and has bugs in it. That's why it got updated in the first place.
Right. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
So we got to come up with a different way. Okay.
So it's probably a catch. Right. Yeah, it's a catch 22. They made ReadyShare easy to access, so the bad guys have easy to access.
Right.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for that. Okay. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. Sorry, we just got a couple minutes left, and we've got someone else waiting on the line. Let's see if we can get them on as well.
Yeah, so it's convenient. A lot of routers have a USB port on them to share files. But your router is your first line of defense. You don't want to share your files from that device.
Right, right. It is doable. But unless it is properly isolated, then no. All right, our next caller is Jim from, I think, Geneva, New York?
No, Greece.
Greece? It's an R. Okay. Hi, Jim. What's up?
Hi. I woke up this morning and I turned on my computer and I could not access pretty much any of my social media sites, including Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. None of my passwords were computing anymore. It's just very frustrating. And I'm just wondering what went wrong.
Are you okay? So you could get to the sites. You couldn't log in because your passwords were wrong.
Yes.
Okay. Do you use the same password on all those sites?
No. But I use Google Password Manager too, and that's completely useless because anytime I've ever tried to utilize it, it's supposed to, save your passwords and stuff. It pretty much never has worked for me. I use different passwords. I do, pretty much everything I'm supposed to do, right, that they tell you to do.
Yeah.
I have different passwords on everything, and then all of a sudden, it's weird because then on my cell phone, I was able to access some of these sites, right? But on my computer, I could not.
I would have Google forget the password and put it in by hand.
Okay. Well, I started writing them down because this is so freaking frustrating.
No, I get it.
I started writing them down.
Every now and then, some companies will force a password reset, but it's unusual for several of them to happen at once.
I would make sure that I would have Google forget all the passwords. I would type them in all by hand, and I would start using a password manager.
Like EnPass.
Like what? Like what would you suggest?
EnPass. ENPASS.
Okay.
That would probably be the best one. It works on your phone. It works on Windows. It works on Linux. It works on the Mac. It works everywhere.
Okay. So you would agree that Google Password Manager is completely useless?
I would not disagree with that statement in the least. All right, we got to go. I'm sorry, Jim.
All right.
Thanks.
I'll call next week and let you know if I made out.
Please. All right, we are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. You have been listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Doggone it! That's Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another. Would you please? We all need it.